Well, that's the United States Air Force theme song, Off We Go Into the Wild Blue Yonder, introducing us here to another episode of Conservative Casual Friday with your show host, Andrew Herod, where we like to examine important issues of the day for conservatives and others on this weekly blog talk radio show every Friday. Well, today we are thinking of going off into the wild blue yonder because we want to discuss America's controversial F-35 fifth generation fighter jet with stealth capability, whether this F-35 Lightning II and whether it's a lightning or a lemon, discuss the controversies over this defense program since its inception in 2001, the last 20 years. And to discuss these issues, we're joined by Dan Grazier, the Jack Shanahan Fellow at the Center for Defense Information of the Project on Government Oversight, POGO, and he is both an experienced journalist as well as a United States Marine Corps combat veteran who has served with Marine Corps tank forces in both Iraq and Afghanistan, tank forces, as we were just recently discussing, which the Marine Corps is going to phase out in its inventory. But here we're going to discuss air power and the F-35. So welcome to the show, Dan Grazier.
Hey, Andrew. Thank you very much for having me.
Well, you've been a longstanding critic of the F-35. You've written about it a lot at POGO, at its Center for Defense Information. For our listeners, start out, describe the history and the problems of the F-35.
Well, that's a big, broad subject right there. So the F-35 was born in kind of the early to mid-1990s. It originally started off to be a straight one-off replacement for the Marine Corps Harrier. And so as a Marine, I often have to kind of hang my head in shame by admitting that the F-35 was born as a Marine Corps program, but it eventually kind of transmogrified into this joint service kind of all-purpose aircraft. For anybody who is familiar with the story of the Bradley and the Pentagon Wars, the F-35 was kind of the aircraft version of that, where it was an approved program in the Marine Corps, and then somebody got the good idea of, well, we have this approved program. Why can't we just build, why can't we use this one program and expand it to make it do multiple missions for three different services? And when you do that, that creates a whole cascade of problems. It drastically increased the cost of the program and increases the complexity, which means that you're likely never going to get all the capabilities that you wanted originally, but in the end, you're going to end up spending a fortune for a less capable program.
Yeah, that's interesting. So now with the F-35 program, we have these, for the United States, we have these three variants, the F-35A, which is supposed to be the Air Force sort of multi-role fighter bomber stealth aircraft, and then the F-35B is then this Marine Corps version, which, as you indicated, like the Harrier, has this VSTOL jump jet capability to take off with short takeoffs and then make sort of helicopter-like vertical landings. And that was then co-produced with the British, who are also going to be replacing their Harriers, their jump jets in their Navy with the F-35. And then the F-35C, which is the naval variant, which is going to service for the United States Navy as a naval aircraft for takeoff of carriers. And so people have described this as this Swiss Army knife of an aircraft supposed to solve all these problems, all these issues, missions for all these services. But others have said that it's now turned out to be like what a camel is. You know, camel is, as the old saying goes, it's a horse designed by committee that is just trying to do too much. And so it's really hard developing a plane like this. Well, have the problems of the F-35 been solved? Discuss some of the problems that have developed, and have they been now solved over the 20-year development history of this aircraft?
Certainly not. There are a whole host of problems, and just the most recent documentation that came out of the Director of Operational Test and Evaluation and the Government Accountability Office shows that there are still nearly 900 unresolved design flaws in this program 20 years into development. And what the program leaders in the Pentagon have decided to do is that instead of completing all of that development work, which they can't do within the existing development budget, they are punting a lot of the design work and the deficiency mitigation efforts into a later phase, which they call either Block 4 or the CQD2 process that's going to happen over the next couple of years. And that's something I think a lot of Americans really need to understand, is that despite all of the money that's being spent, more than $100 million per aircraft, they're getting an incomplete product. And down the road, they're going to end up having to spend even more money to finish that development work. You know, the analogy would be is, you know, if you go down to a Verizon store and you pay full price for your Galaxy phone, and then you're told that, oh, by the way, in a year, like every 6 months, every year or so, you're going to have to bring it back, and you're going to have to spend more money to get your web browser installed, and then to get your phone app installed. That's what's going on right now with the F-35.
Well, that's very interesting. And, you know, that there was a criticism of the F-35 program was that it was developed with this the program was conducted in this new manner of what is called concurrency, that they actually started producing F-35s even before they had fixed all of these kind of developmental problems. And the idea was that they would later go back to some of these earlier F-35s and sort of update them to the latest standard. So are there still F-35s that need to be updated with sort of the latest fixes in the military?
Yes, every single F-35 that's been produced so far is an incomplete prototype. And to bring them up to that full capability, all of them will need to go back and get these design fixes.
Well, one other important issue that came up in the development of the F-35, sort of a whole set unto itself of issues, was its software program. In particular, the F-35 had this, what was called the Autonomic Logistics Information System, or ALIS, which apparently now is going to be replaced by a whole new system called the Operational Data Information Network, if I'm getting that, if I'm remembering that correctly, the ODIN system. The very advanced computer systems, they would involve things like at bases, F-35s, they would upload data on like maintenance and the missions they had just done that would then be sent to bases or laboratories in the United States that could then analyze that and send out sort of computer software fixes or information on what sort of repairs to make. There are all sorts of questions about this, like, you know, it could be hacked. Also, there are questions of, you know, foreign countries like Israel buying such F-35s. They could be sharing their information with the United States, or even that the United States could use this system to stop the operation of the F-35. Have all these issues, are all these issues going to be solved in this new software program called ODIN?
Well, that very much remains to be seen. There's a lot of skepticism among the test community and through the Director of Operational Test and Evaluation, and the GAO has written about this as well. about how, yes, ALICE was a deeply flawed system, and despite multiple years of trying to correct it, they weren't able to even come close to doing that. And so the decision was made to scrap that and then go to this new system. Well, unfortunately, the new system was, is for one, it's actually suffering a lot of the same development problems that led to the disastrous results with ALICE. And there's even less known about how the development process for Odin is going to unfold and how it's going to be tested as well. It's already fallen behind schedule. We haven't really seen budget numbers on it yet, but I suspect that those are going to increase dramatically here in the next, coming months and in years. The big story and the big takeaway for, both ALICE and Odin is that they really just tried to do too much with this. So, like you mentioned, ALICE was meant to be this kind of, do everything data network where it was supposed to, the onboard diagnostics systems in the F-35 were supposed to upload data to ALICE, and then the program was supposed to automatically create maintenance work orders and order parts and track those replacement parts through the distribution network, and then guide the, and then once the parts arrived where they were needed, then ALICE was supposed to guide the maintainers as they fixed the problem on a broken aircraft. And, and then in addition to that, it was also supposed to, take all that threat data that was gathered during a mission and then upload it to the labs, and they were supposed to update the mission data loads that were then supposed to be sent back out. That's a lot of moving parts, and that's a really big load on an information network. And, when, if I remember correctly, I think there's 24 million lines of software code involved in ALICE. And so naturally a program that's that big is going to have a lot of software bugs. And the problem that the program found and they had that just absolutely buggered them to death was the simple reality of software development that when you patch software in one place, you often end up causing problems elsewhere that then have to be fixed. And so it becomes this really vicious cycle where you add all these patches and it creates, that one patch might create two or three different problems someplace that then have to also have to be patched. And so you can see how that's a spiraling problem that becomes very difficult to solve. And in the case of ALICE, they basically came to the realization that they couldn't solve it, and so they decided to scrap it and go with something new. But unfortunately, because it's such a tall order, I have a sneaking suspicion that Odin will suffer ultimately the same fate as ALICE.
Yeah, these 24 million lines of code in ALICE, I remember reading it was something like six times the amount of code in like the systems were an F-6 or an F-18. It's a significant leap in computer demands, software demands. And it was interesting, too, reading that this ALICE system apparently required, like, you have to deploy with the aircraft in any forward base, like an ALICE operational unit for the squadron, and then you have to upload the planes there at the base to the squadron, and that like each plane can take like a day to upload to the system at a new base. So it's a very complicated operational process to deploy this. I found that very interesting.
And that creates a bunch of logistics problems too. Now, big military units like an aircraft squadron is obviously going to have a footprint. But by adding, by trying to add capabilities like ALICE, it just increases an already big problem for any military unit. And then when you add all that, the time issues. you create a force that isn't very nimble.
Well, how does the F-35 compare with, say, other stealth aircraft like the F-22, or even going back to the sort of the first generation of stealth, the B-20, the B-2 bomber, or the old, now taken out of service, the F-117 fighter, as it was called, actually an attack aircraft. How have these other stealth programs fared, like the F-22? Have they been successful, or how well have they performed?
Well, the F-22's been around. They stopped production on the F-22 10 years ago now, that program was curtailed, and its numbers were cut pretty dramatically from the original plans. The F-22 hasn't had a great impact operationally speaking. It's played only a really minimal role in combat operations over the last 20 years or so. Now, part of that is probably just simple pragmatism, because in the kind of combat that we've seen over the last 20 years, sending a $350 million plus aircraft like the F-22 to strike some of these targets is one of the greatest cases of overkill that I could imagine. But operationally speaking, stealth has its place. It's not the end all be all though. So that's something that I think a lot of people kind of miss. Like, there isn't necessarily a technical solution or a technological solution to every single problem. The A-10 is a really great example of that. The A-10, as a lot of its critics like to point out, is not a stealth aircraft. Well, that's very true. It was never designed to be a stealth aircraft. But the A-10 is, deals with the challenges of flying around defended airspace differently than a stealth aircraft does. And a lot of it is just simple tactics. The A-10 pilots are highly skilled and really smart guys. And over the years, they've developed tactics on how to avoid a lot of these ground-based air defense threats. Simple train masking, type efforts can defeat a lot of anti-aircraft systems. And then the simple fact that the A-10 was built with a really rugged design and is capable of taking a hit is another survival method. Your listeners, if they're interested, you can Google A-10 damage and pull up some of the images, and you can find pictures of A-10s that are absolutely riddled with enemy bullet holes and having an engine blown up, but the aircraft was able to return to base, and his pilot was able to live to fight another day. So it's again, stealth has its place, but it's not the end all be all. There are other ways to kind of solve that problem and deal with those challenges of operating over a modern battlefield.
Yeah, I mean, the A-10, we're talking about an aircraft that was introduced in 1977, so that's really an old legacy aircraft, as they call it, in the United States military, and it has this titanium armor. It has, surrounding the pilot and the main body of the plane, it has this, like, titanium kind of, like, it's been called, like, a bathtub before, but, the vitals of the plane are really protected with heavy armor, so it can really get down low and sustain a lot of ground fire. Well, has the going back to the F-35 and the F-22, have they been used in combat now that, we're looking at talking about the inception of the F-35 program in 2001 and going through these wars in this context of this global war on terrorism in Afghanistan, Iraq, and elsewhere? Have the F-35 or the F-22 seen really any combat? You indicated before, of course, the F-22 is not really something we need in, like, Afghanistan or Iraq.
Right. The F-22 has seen very little, and the F-35 has also seen very little. And most of those were kind of, more demonstrations than anything. I had a conversation recently with someone with some knowledge about the issue, like in Afghanistan. There was, there were efforts to push more F-35s in Afghanistan, and the headquarters really wanted to get the F-35 more experience. But apparently, the JTACs on the ground, the Joint Tactical Air Controllers on the ground, were not all that interested in having F-35s, just because they had a difficult time communicating with the F-35s. I think there were some station issues where the F-35s weren't able to, to loiter around long enough, and the existing, I don't really like the term legacy aircraft, but the proven aircraft were far more reliable in the eyes of the controllers on the ground.
Yeah, I mean, particularly in Afghanistan, right, you're thinking, what sort of air defense does the Taliban have, or for that matter, say, in the air campaign in Libya in 2011 or against Iraq, Saddam Hussein in Iraq in 2003, the air defenses there are probably not that advanced. So such a high-performing stealth aircraft doesn't give you that much advantage. Well, I'm thinking of the A-10 in the future of what is called close air support, CAS, or ground support missions. It's been discussed that, the A-10 with its 30-millimeter cannon, its main weapon, it has something like 1,100 rounds to fire, whereas the various variants of the F-35 only have something like 180 to 220 rounds to fire for its 25-millimeter gun. Can the F-35 really replace the A-10 in the close air support CAS role? For example, I've seen some indication in writing that people are thinking you could do close air support with like a high up aircraft in the future with like maybe precision weapons or something.
Right. Well, and that's long been the dream, particularly of leaders in the Air Force, is that because they always like to say that close air support is a mission, not a platform. Well, that's true up to a certain extent, but there are a lot of issues with using aircraft that fly very high in a close air support role. There was a pretty famous incident from a couple years ago in Afghanistan where a B-1 was used for close air support. And it ended up being a really serious friendly fire incident where a number of people on the ground were killed, and it wasn't completely a technology problem with it as much as it was a pilot skill issue, and it was for something really simple. Unfortunately, that's what makes this such a tragic story, because the controllers on the ground told the pilot to look for the infrared strobes that the soldiers on the ground were wearing. Well, the B-1 pilot didn't know that his optics couldn't see IR strobes, and so he saw with his optics being employed very high up at 20 plus thousand feet. Saw people on the ground, thought he was looking at the right target, and dropped a bomb and ended up killing, if I remember correctly, it was six coalition soldiers on the ground. And when you're talking about the A-10, and this is one of my favorite issues, I actually wrote my graduate thesis about this. The really important thing about the A-10 program is not the great aircraft, and it is really a great aircraft. But it's the fact that the A-10 program organically developed a group of dedicated close air support pilots that specialized in that one very, very complex mission. And so through the years, through now multiple generations of A-10 pilots, you have this dedicated cadre of pilots that focus on the attack mission. And you just don't get that with a multi-role program like the F-35, because it is a multi-role aircraft. The pilots have to train to a number of different missions. And you know, one of the biggest problems with the F-35 program is it just does not fly all that often. Its mission capable rates, and particularly its fully mission capable rates, are far below what the services need to be truly effective. And so when you have that limited training time because the aircraft are not available all that often, then commanders have to prioritize what missions they train to. And for commanders who are much more interested in the missions that glorify air power, the air-to-air combat and the deep strike missions that are kind of the hallmark of the Air Force, they're very likely going to prioritize training to those missions, and close air support is going to get shortchanged in that. And so, those kind of skills are going to atrophy, certainly in the F-35 community, if they ever truly develop, which I have my doubts that the close air support F-35 skills will really develop to the point where they need to be. And then if the A-10 program ends up going away in the future before a dedicated attack aircraft replacement is put in service, then the United States is going to find itself in a position where it's been in the past, unfortunately, in World War II, in Korea, and in Vietnam. We entered those wars without having developed really good close air support skills, and so pilots had to learn on the fly, and unfortunately a lot of soldiers died on the ground in the process as those skills were being developed.
Yeah, well, that's an interesting comment. Yeah, so you have to look beyond the mere technology of the plane, also to the person flying it, and you really need people trained on the systems for those missions. So it's sort of the man behind the weapon that's also important as well. And if you're not and so a multi-role program, multi-role weapon then involves training people for multiple roles, which really weakens the commitment to any one single mission. That's interesting. Well, thinking about the F-35 or F-22 or any of these other stealth aircraft, are they really only useful for really sort of high-tech, high-intensity warfare missions? I mean, you might think like, operating against a contingency of fighting Russia or, say, China, Russia in like the Baltics, or China and like over Taiwan or something, where you really need an advanced aircraft to go against advanced air defenses, or perhaps even somewhat Iran or North Korea. But again, thinking of like the whole broad range of missions you might fight in Afghanistan or in the Middle East against countries like Syria or something, is such a stealth aircraft really useful? Just how often would a country like the United States need to use a stealth aircraft?
Well, hopefully never, because the kind of war for which stealth aircraft like the F-22 and F-35 are designed for, in one sense, it's difficult to even fathom how that kind of a war could be fought, because we're talking about fighting a conventional war against a nuclear armed enemy, and the military war fights this a lot, scenarios like this a lot, and what they found is that a lot of those scenarios go nuclear very quickly. So it's really important that we try to avoid having to put the F-35 into the kind of situation for which it was designed, because that kind of a conflict can get out of hand very quickly. But you certainly don't need, something. You certainly don't need a $350 million-plus dollar F-22 to fight in Afghanistan. And a lot of times you don't even need, an F-16 or an F-15 or an F-18 for that, which is why there's been this really amazing effort over the years, by some really dedicated Air Force officers, kind of operating below the general officer level, to develop a light attack aircraft. you know, the Air Force brass does not like that kind of idea because their whole identity is based on big bombers that can, you know, fly straight to Moscow and you know, fighter aircraft that can, you know, fly at Mach 2. You know, so the idea of a propeller-driven, you know, very slow, you know, very inexpensive light attack fighter is kind of anathema, you know, to their identity. But that's really the kind of aircraft that you need for that kind of a situation. You know, the A-10 has operated very well in Afghanistan as well. And, you know, I know when I arrived in Bagram, I was really excited to see the A-10s taken off there. And, you know, because that's the kind of aircraft that you need for that kind of a scenario. And you know, we are – in one sense, very fortunate that those are the kind of wars that we fought. And, you know, I don't mean to be flippant about that because they've been, you know, they've been kind of big tragedies, but they are, I much rather fight a war like Afghanistan than I would, you know, like to fight a war against China. But, we unfortunately spend, you know, these vast sums of money buying a military for that scenario, and then we try to shoehorn it into these less intense conflicts, and there's often kind of a mismatch there where you end up wearing out these really expensive systems, you know, flying every day when that's not really what they were designed to do. It's important for us it's important for you know, Pentagon leaders and members of Congress to make prudent decisions. You know, do we really need 2,400 F-35s when, you know, maybe we could get away with maybe 500 or so? And I'm kind of pulling that number out of a hat at the moment. But we could probably get away with a smaller fleet of the higher capable, you know, level aircraft. I'm not saying the F-35 specifically, you know, but something, you know, of the same concept and of the same design level, I guess. And but then have a bigger fleet of you know, less high tech aircraft, but they're less expensive if we buy them in greater numbers to be able to, you know, to operate as the everyday fighter. And that's another important caveat to this whole story. The F-35 was originally intended to be that everyday fighter. Back in the 90s, as the force designers were coming up with their plans, the F-22 was supposed to be that high-end fighter, and the F-35 was supposed to be the lower-end kind of everyday fighter that was only supposed to cost about like $40 million per copy. And but, you know, along the way, I think the F-35 kind of lost it, kind of lost the plot. And, now it's kind of morphed into this really expensive command and control, you know, quarterback aircraft that's now supposed to direct, collect information and pass it on to the actual shooters, which is why we're now seeing us buying more, you know, F-15s and F-18s in the Navy. And there's even talk about building a new upgraded or updated version of something like the F-16. The evolution of that over the years has been really interesting, and now to the point where you kind of have to ask the question, like, what is the F-35 for anymore?
Yeah, I find that interesting. I remember reading years ago in various defense publications, Air Force Journal, and so forth, that people in the Air Force were saying, yeah, the F-22 will be the top-of-the-line fighter, you know, like the F-15 in the past, but the F-35 is going to be like the F-16, say. You know, it's going to be the common, you know, workaday plane. And as you're indicating here, you know, here the F-35 is becoming really just as high-end as the F-22. And now the Air Force, for example, has recently purchased new F-15Xs, F-15EXs, this sort of latest version of the F-15 that's been developed in sort of conjunction with F-15s that Qatar Gutter has recently purchased. And so the Air Force is going in for an update of the F-15. And It's been noted that aircraft like the F-15 or the F-16, they cost about like half as much per hour to operate as the F-35, something like some $40,000, $44,000 or so, compared to like $20,000 for the F-16 or the F-15. I mean, looking at costs like that, how does it stand with the F-35 program now? About how many F-35s do you think the United States is going to buy? The planned projection of the program, I believe, was something like 1,763 aircraft. What are we looking at in a forced deployment in the future?
Well, that's the big question now, because there's a long history of some of our premier weapon systems that end up getting cut as the costs rise. You know, I've written about this. I call the phenomenon the complexity vortex. You know, as the complexity goes up and the cost goes up, then the numbers start coming down. Because originally, when you go back, like, you know, in the case of the F-22. When you really go back and you start digging through some of the older documents, there was talk about having 850 F-22s, but as the cost rose, then step by step, the planned fleet was kept decreasing. 850, then it went to 650, and it kept going down from there, and then it finally ended. Secretary Robert Gates ended the F-22 program at 187 aircraft. It remains to be seen if that's going to happen with the F-22 or with the F-35. I'm sorry. Right now, even though we're still technically in low rate initial production, because legally the F-35 does not qualify for full rate production yet. We're still buying them at 96 per year. By last count, which is full rate production in everything but name, and it doesn't. There are hints now. In one of the latest hearings about 2 or 3 weeks ago, there were a couple of members of Congress that said that they aren't going to they're gonna expend every effort to block increased F-35 production for the time being, but it remains to be seen if the overall planned fleet will get cut. But history definitely suggests that it does. Just with all of the problems, the extended development, the ever increasing costs, history is not on the F-35 side with that. Because we've seen it with the F-22 program, we saw it with the B-2 program, and even beyond aircraft. We've seen it with the littoral combat ship in the Navy, and we've also seen it with the Navy's Zumwalt. The DDG program that was originally supposed to have 33 ships of that class, and we're going to end up with 3, and it all has to do with spiraling costs and development problems.
Yeah, and the Zumwalt class destroyer for the Navy, that was then again another stealth program. I mean, there the Zumwalt ship, this destroyer, was supposed to incorporate stealth into its design. That's interesting. I haven't followed that program that closely, but you say it's gone from 33 ships to 3, so that's really a significant reduction. Well, do you think that future generation of stealth aircraft will be able to solve or mitigate some of these problems with the F-35? And if we look at the F-22 or the F-35, are we really kind of talking about sort of the infancy of stealth technology, but maybe in coming decades we'll be able to improve and this will become more standardized?
Well, that is my earnest hope with this. I think at this point with the F-35 program, the best thing that can come out of it are solid lessons learned. And there are fortunately some indications of that. Over the years, there was one of the program executive officers, Lieutenant General Chris Bogdan. He admitted that that creating one aircraft for all services was a really bad idea, and he thinks it should never happen again. Well, he was right. I totally agree with that. That was one of the biggest mistakes, like when the F-35 was still just sketches in the back of a napkin, that was made. And, you know, so if we can learn that lesson, if we can learn the lesson that we need to, we should build specialized aircraft for their intended tasks. So if we need a fighter aircraft, then we build a dedicated fighter aircraft. And, you know, we keep that design as simple as possible, you know, to perform its intended task, then that will greatly reduce the cost of the program. And it will also, it will make the technological challenges involved in that much more achievable. And, you know, so if we learn some of these basic lessons, then moving forward, I think that we can achieve these goals. But it's, you know, we have to first learn these lessons and then we have to apply them. And it goes beyond just the aircraft, even like the management, you know, or the, I should say the concepts behind, some of these acquisition choices. Like a big problem, one of the reasons why the operating costs of the F-35 program are so high is because that was baked into the program from the very beginning. There was a fad back in the 1990s, in particular, in defense acquisitions called the total system performance responsibility. And that's the idea where when the contract for a program like the F-35 is awarded, the thinking was that the private sector can do things better than the government can. And in a lot of cases, I agree that that is absolutely true. But in this case, it becomes a big problem when you're talking about weapon systems, because what happened was the services basically just handed over their responsibility for maintaining their own weapons programs to the contractor, and it became the contractor's responsibility to perform the vast majority of the maintenance for the F-35. Well, that theory, I guess, works. It's really good for the bottom line of the contractor, but it's not so good for the services, because now the maintainers, and you find this in a lot of the documentation, like the Government Accountability Office writes about this often in their reports, even just in the last couple of weeks, about how maintainers on the flight line trying to work on the F-35 can't perform a lot of maintenance actions because they don't have either the technical knowledge, because the services don't own the intellectual property, they don't own the data rights to the F-35, or they don't have the tools to be able to do a lot of basic maintenance actions that the services have been doing forever with aircraft programs. And so when something breaks, a lot of times you have to pull the broken part off the F-35 and you have to hand it over to one of the field service representatives, the contractors, and they have to go perform the maintenance action, if they can even do it there, because a lot of these maintenance actions have to go someplace else to the depots to get fixed. And that causes all kinds of logistics problems. It certainly increases the expense, and it's just a bad way of doing business. I could tell you stories. I experienced that personally in the tank community in the Marine Corps, because the General Dynamics and the other contractors that were building new systems for the tanks were kind of doing the same thing, where they were designing components particularly for the ballistics system in the tank that could only be worked on by the field service representatives, and my maintenance crews, you know, all they could do was pull a component out and hope that they had a replacement component available to be able to plug back in, and when we didn't, then we had a bent tank, and which was always a problem for us.
Well, that's interesting. I remember reading that in some discussion of the F-35 that it did indeed require civilian contractors to go with it. I guess in particular, I saw that reference to this software, Alice system, rather. But you're saying also for repairs, you have to have these contractors going along, which is, I guess, you know, not necessarily someone you want to deploy with. I mean, you want to have military personnel going into a potential combat zone. So that's interesting that both here with the F-35 and other systems, the military is really sort of outsourcing its maintenance. It's really relying on the producer, in the case of the F-35, Lockheed Martin, to continue that maintenance for the plane.
Right. Well, and that's a, you know, that's a big problem just beyond, you know, beyond the F-35. There was a lot of criticism in Iraq and Afghanistan about how troops were living on these big lavish bases, and which was true. Like I certainly experienced that in Camp Fallujah and in Camp Leatherneck, you know, Camp Fallujah in Iraq and then Camp Leatherneck in Afghanistan, where they were these big sprawling bases. But when you walk around, you see there were a ton of civilians on those bases. And, you know, there were the, you know, the service contractors that were running the, you know, the dining facilities and things like that. But then there were just a lot of contractors around who were, you know, performing maintenance on weapons and a whole bunch of other things. And so we had to, you know, just as a matter of force protection, we had to build these big bases and we had to man these big bases to protect the contractors. And because there are frankly certain things that contractors won't do that service members will do. And so it becomes this big, huge logistics problem down the road. And it's really just not the way things should be done. You know, your listeners, when they get in their cars and go out to dinner here on this, hopefully beautiful Friday night that we're all going to enjoy, you're going to see Jeeps running around. Well, these are, Jeeps came directly from World War II. And, you know, the reason why people drive Jeeps even today is because the soldiers of World War II fell in love with these all-terrain 4x4 vehicles that they were issued because they were rugged and because they were simple. And when they were reliable, but when they did break down, the soldiers were able to fix them in the field. And, you know, there weren't any, General Motors field service representatives rolling around, northern France during the advance from Normandy, you know, to fix these Jeeps. Soldiers were doing that themselves. That's the way that a weapons program should be designed. And that is possible to do. The contractor designs themselves out of the weapon. And moving forward, that should be, you know, goal number one for any weapons program. I often, you know, when I talk to people on Capitol Hill, I always try to tell them that, hey, you know what, the next time somebody comes up and tries to sell you an aircraft, one of the first questions you should ask before you approve that program is you should ask how many field service representatives is it going to take to support this? And if the answer is really more than one, then they probably shouldn't approve that program because that's not where we should be. And, you know, to really narrow this down to the F-35 program, one of the biggest problems they're having right now with the program are engines. And, one, they aren't delivering engines fast enough to meet the service's needs because they're ramping up production of the airframes faster than they've ramped up production of the engines. So there's a shortage of engines. But then that problem is compounded by the fact that the manufacturer, Pratt & Whitney, made promises about how reliable the engine was going to be, that it was going to be able to operate for so many hours without having to go down for maintenance. Well, those promises turned out to be wildly optimistic and nowhere close to reality. But unfortunately, people made plans based on those promises. And so now what's going on is the depots, the maintenance depots that are set up to fix the engines do not have the capacity to deal with this influx of broken engines because they're coming in at a much faster rate than was anticipated. And so now, you know, everyone's scrambling to increase that capacity and they're falling short.
Well, that's interesting. Well, speaking of maintaining these planes and capacity and contractors and so forth, the F-35 then is now being purchased not just by the United States but other countries. For example, the United Kingdom was one of the co-developers of the plane in the first place. And now Israel has also bought the F-35, and there are unconfirmed reports that Israel in 2018 overflew Tehran with a flight of three F-35s, and the Iranians weren't even able to register it. That's sort of touted as a great success of the F-35, and we had this recent sale of the F-35 to the United Arab Emirates, and I believe that Japan has also bought the F-35. What experiences have these foreign countries then had with the F-35?
Well, the only country that I'm aware of that's had any kind of combat experience with it is are the Israelis, and you know, I've also read the reports about the Tehran overflight. I've seen video on YouTube of the F-35I, the Israeli version, flying over Syria. Now, the F-35 that the Israelis have is different from the ones that we get. So there's actually a number of partner nations. You know, you mentioned the United Kingdom and Israel, but countries like Norway and Denmark and Australia are also partner nations where, you know, they contributed to the development of the F-35 from the very beginning. Well, the Israelis did that too, but they got special concessions in it where they have the Israelis have special data rights for the F-35, so they've been able to make modifications unique to them, you know, unique to themselves. Apparently, at least if the reports that are available on the open market are to be believed, the Israelis have had some success with the F-35, but that success does not necessarily translate or cannot necessarily be extrapolated out to everybody that gets the F-35 because the Israeli F-35s are unique to Israel.
Interesting. And I believe also I found interesting, I guess the Netherlands, Holland, was also one of the co-developers of the F-35, and that sort of continued a role that Holland had. They were also one of the original co-developers of the F-16 with General Dynamics. So, I believe they're in the
I'm going to have to clarify something there. So nobody, there was no other country that was a co-developer of the F-16 that was developed by the United States. Now there were foreign buyers lined up for the F-16 before the development process was completed, but they weren't bought into the program. They didn't contribute to the development. They might have submitted some wish lists, but and that's a big difference with the F-35. The F-16 was developed for the United States, and then it was sold overseas. So that simplified the development process. But going back to the beginning of this, the problems with the F-35 are, it was designed as a multi-role aircraft. Well, that's a level of complexity. Well, then you layer on the complexity of making a multi-role aircraft for multiple services. So that ups the complexity. Well, then you really take that to a whole different level when, from the very beginning, you design it to meet the needs of multiple roles, of multiple services, of multiple countries. And you can see how that complexity just expands outwards and contributes a lot to the development delays and the increased costs of this. So, yeah, the F-16 was very different. It was designed specifically to be an air-to-air aircraft for the Air Force. And then later on it was sold to other countries. But that's certainly not the case with the F-35.
Huh. And thinking of a development of aircraft, what has been the development of stealth in other countries? I mean, thinking about like potential adversaries of the United States, China and Russia, or for that matter, what about in Europe aside from, I guess we've had this European role in the F-35, but have the Europeans ever thought of any particular stealth programs themselves?
I'm sure they thought about it, but I don't think the Rafael, the Eurofighter, or any of the other like the Typhoon or the other aircraft that they're developing are stealth aircraft.
And what about China and Russia? What their experience has been with stealth?
Well, they so uh, you know, the SU 35, you know, the J-20 in China are, you know, their answers, the fifth generation, you know, our fifth generation aircraft. And, you know, from again, what I'm able to, you know, to read on, you know, open sources, have some stealth capabilities, but I guess it kind of remains to be seen, at least you know, the non-classified sources that I have, about how effective they might actually be.
Uh-huh. Interesting. Well, looking at the other side of the equation, looking at a counter-stealth measure that's been talked about, I mean, you've written about how, I mean, going back to the 1999 Kosovo air campaign, there the Serbian forces were able to find ways to use, as you mentioned, the long-wave radars that they had to actually shoot down one particular F-117 and damage another. You also talked about these passive defense systems that you can monitor, like the radio systems, radar and so forth on a plane, to perhaps detect a plane and shoot it down. How are those measures developing, and could that make then stealth obsolete or negate the advantage of stealth?
Well, it's certainly possible. As kind of a guiding principle, it's always important to remember that generally there is there's almost always a low-tech solution to a high-tech problem, and so it doesn't surprise me. You know, the F-117 example is a really good one, because that was you know, long-wave radar, kind of an old one actually, that was used to, you know, to spot the F-117s, and then they were able to communicate to other air defense systems, and were able to, you know, to hit, you know, stealth aircraft. And yeah, some of the, you know, the passive detection systems that can detect, you know, like a search radar emanating from the aircraft, and the infrared passive detectors that can detect the very large heat signature that comes out of that one massive jet engine out of the back of the F-35 is one way to, you know, to defeat stealth. But even like the audio signature of the F-35. If you've ever been around one flying, and I have a couple times now, I was actually standing on Capitol Hill when the F-15 or the F-35B put on that big show for the Polish president a couple years ago. I mean, you could hear that that aircraft coming from a long way away. That was down on the Gulf Coast of Florida this past summer. And a couple of F-35s overflew me, and I could hear them coming and going for a very long time. So it's, you know, a lot of things like that. Like, stealth has its place, but it's not the panacea that that people trying to sell you stealth aircraft try to make it out to be. So, you know, moving forward, I think it's important to kind of, you know, maybe start looking beyond that. You know, do we really need to send manned aircraft into defended airspace? I don't think so in a lot of cases. So maybe we, you know, I think it's long past time for us to really kind of look beyond that, you know, unmanned systems, you know, overflying to be able to locate targets, and then the weapon, you know, using, you know, striking with a weapon that can be launched at a distance from beyond that defended airspace. You know, I think it's long past time for us to really explore those options.
Yeah, that's very interesting. I remember when the Serbian case was discussed, people were saying that they sort of like flooded the zone with their various radars, and that way they were then able to pick up the F-117. And it's interesting you talk about just the audio, the sound of such stealth aircraft. You can hear them, so that at least gives you some indication. Well, this has been very interesting. Yeah.
Well, I was just going to say, yeah, that audio signature is huge. And, you know, if you can get people looking in the right direction, then you can get other systems looking for it, you know, looking for that threat to them coming, you know, from that audio signature.
All right, then. Well, for our listeners out there, this has been another episode of Conservative Casual Friday, a weekly blog talk radio show with your show host, Andrew Herod. And we've been discussing the America's controversial F-35 Lightning II aircraft here with Dan Grazier, the Jack Shanahan Fellow at the Center for Defense Information of the Project on Government Oversight. Well, Dan Grazier, thank you very much for joining the show.
Hey, Andrew, thank you very much for having me.
All right, then, for our listeners, join us next week for another episode of Conservative Casual Friday.